The Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab, number 120 for Friday, September 14th, 2007.
Greetings, folks, and welcome to the Mac Observer's Mac Geek... why can't I say that anymore? 2.5 years I've been saying this. Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab. It is a special weekend show simply because of a scheduling conflict that we have next week. So,
yeah, I'm going to Embedded Systems Conference up in Boston.
You're coming up here?
Here is Boston.
Yeah. You got any nights open for dinner? I can come down and have dinner with you. All right, we'll look at your schedule.
You know, I think so. Well, two nights. I mean, you know, it's a trade show, so two nights they have.
Yeah.
Well, they have basically nighttime. They got a casino night, and they got a roam the show floor with a drink night. You know, they take care of. They help help people socialize and
absolutely
learn about technology and buy more stuff. So yeah, this is and this is going to be fun. I think Embedded Embedded is a whole very cool area.
Oh,
very it makes
cool.
all our it makes all our toys work.
It in fact it does. That's right. So we have pretty much a standard Geek Gab, if there's any, if that actually means anything, going through your questions, sharing your tips, solving some problems that have come up along the way, and just generally trying to impart good knowledge and share good knowledge. So last week we got to talking about macOS 10 passwords, and we made some comments about passwords being limited to 8 characters, and also that open firmware password didn't exist on Intel Macs. And we've actually got some corrections, one from Wally, which we'll talk about first, and one, believe it or not, from our very own John F. Braun. Yeah, I know this guy. But Wally, I don't know, but glad to have made his acquaintance. Wally writes, you're right about passwords only being significant to 8 characters. However, it's the first 8 characters of the hash that the OS makes of whatever it is you enter as a password. Thus, the passwords the brown cow and the brown dog are not equivalent. I tested this to be sure. And Wally, you're right. To kind of boil this down to the essence, and I realize that I'm gonna leap over some things here, but essentially, when you create a password in the OS, what it does is it encrypts the password and kind of mangles it, and that's what the hash is for, and then it saves this encrypted hashed, i.e. mangled version on the disk. Then when you go to, and this is what any Unix does these days, then when you go to log in, you type your username, which goes in the clear, typically, and then you type your password, and then the system encrypts and mangles whatever you typed in the same way that it encrypted and mangled it the first time, and it compares the encrypted and mangled version, or the encrypted and hashed version, to what it has on the disk. And if the two are the same at the first up to the first 8 characters, you're fine. But as Wally pointed out, even if the first 8 characters of your password are the same, that doesn't mean that even if only the first 8 characters of your password are the same and the rest aren't, it doesn't mean that that the first 8 characters of the hash are going to remain the same. And so you can have a longer password and have that potentially be different from what a password with the same first 8 characters and a different extension would be. So, John, do you have anything quick to add to that for us here?
Very quickly, I would say, yeah. So you get 8 characters. I'm not sure if they're talking about 8 bytes or 8 nibbles or whatever, but there's the more the better. But I would say, 8 characters worth is enough. And then very quickly. So the scenario is, even if you have 2 passwords, that are off by 1 character, by nature of what they're doing, which you talked about, which is hashing, encrypting, and we won't go into too much detail, but suffice to say that stuff happens. There's no chance that if you are 1 letter off. I mean, the dumb way to do it is to store the raw passwords in a file, which I guess they did in the early days.
Yes, they did. Yeah.
So, So by not storing the actual password. I think that about covers it, because we could go into quite a bit of detail.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I'll link to an article that actually talked about a lot of this and the history of how it was done and some of the protocols and all that.
Cool.
Because it is pretty interesting how it's evolved over the years.
Cool. All right. On to the open firmware password. I stated that the open firmware didn't exist on the Intel machines and that they had EFI. And therefore, there was no way to do a firmware password. Well, the latter part of that statement, John found, and as did many of you, found not to be true. And John, go ahead and I'll let you go ahead and explain what you found.
Yeah. So what you said was technically correct, that the newer Macs have EFI, not open firmware. And I think the problem here, now actually I'd like to ask you this because you said you did this for me, is, you know, I found one of the support articles and they say, all right, if you want to find the utility that does this, which is Open Firmware Password 1.0.2, apparently the version that you download is, I guess, only for PowerPC, but there is one that's on your local install disk in application/utilities.
Right.
So basically they say this, go to your disk to pull this utility off. And I believe you looked, Dave, and you saw that there was something. Was it called Open Firmware Password?
Firmware Password Utility, I believe, if I'm pulling this from memory. But it essentially it results in the same thing. So you certainly have the capability of doing this with an Intel Mac, and Apple did not deny us that. Personally, I don't do that. If I have data that is overly sensitive, I encrypt it in a different way, and that way I don't run the risk of somehow forgetting the password that's going to get me into my Mac. So there you go.
Right. But I think it's a great additional step for people, especially if you have a portable.
Yeah.
And want to, you know, make it very difficult for someone. Again, I think we said before, if they have your machine and they have physical access, it's pretty much game over. But this could make it difficult for someone who is maybe not that quite determined, or, you know, in a shared environment, like in a lab or something like that.
Yeah.
You know, in a school or something, I think I do this just to prevent people from wreaking havoc.
Yeah. In fact, we had quite a few listeners write in, and you, a lot of you said, you know, in a school lab, it actually makes a lot of sense because it is one more layer that gets in the way of changing anything that shouldn't be changed. So that's not a bad thing. Reaching back while we're dealing with follow-ups from previous shows, reaching back a little bit, we talked about securing individual applications and kind of came up with some ideas for that. And we've actually got an audio comment here, so I'll run this. I think.
Hello, John and Dave. I had a hint for the guy from Scotland who wanted to restrict access to applications to certain users. Well, remember, this is a Unix system we're dealing with here, and you can change the execute permissions for users and groups. If you really wanted to go low rent and hardcore, you could put applications into groups and put users into groups and only have execute permissions for the people in the group. And there you go. Just an idea. Thanks. See ya.
Thank you very much. Yeah, and that's a great idea. I did some searching and reading about this, and there's an excellent article by Ryan Foss over at peachpit.com that we'll link to. And it talks about using Workgroup Manager, which is a feature of Mac or an application bundled with Mac OS X Server, but it's freely downloadable. And the article indicates where you can go and get this. And that can help manage these users and groups and really kind of help along those lines. So that is that. I did want to talk about our first sponsor for this show, which is Smile on My Mac with PDF Pen. PDF Pen is an extension that you install into Mac OS X, and well, it's actually an application rather that lets you edit PDF files, and you can print directly to it. So if you've got something, instead of having to print and save it as a PDF and then open it in PDF Pen, there's a path to get directly there. PDF Pen lets you do all sorts of things with PDFs. I use it all the time to put signatures into a PDF, or if I get a fax that I need to sign, I'll paste my signature in, and then you can remove the cover page and you can move pages around. You can actually insert other pages into the PDF and reorder things. Fantastic, easy to use program from smileonmymac.com. That's PDF Pen. And with that, we'll move on to Wayne, who has a question that I think is going to get two different answers.
Hey guys, first I'd like to say, how great show! I love listening to it all the time. My name's Wayne from Houston, Texas. I'm a recent switcher, completely over. I've gone from a notebook and desktop of Windows to a MacBook Pro and a Mac Pro for my photo editing.
Nice.
I have a question, though. I'm trying to understand the way that .Mac Sync works, what its true usefulness is, and whether or not I should trouble myself with even using it. I get conflicting answers depending on which Apple genius I speak to as to whether or not it's any good and which way it syncs, up or down or both ways. And I'm totally confused. You can email me if you want. So
now, we'll talk about it here. It's much more fun. Okay, so I will start by answering the nuts and bolts of this. So the idea behind .Mac Sync, and correct me if I'm wrong here, John, but the idea behind .Mac Sync is that you have data in your address book, keychain, your mail rules and signatures and your accounts, but not your mail data, bookmarks, and I believe that covers most of what most people are going to sync. There's some third-party apps that use it as well. But
and calendars.
And calendars, thank you. That's right. I'm not an iCal guy. I never think about that. So that's right. Thank you. I know. And so the idea is it uses macOS 10 sync services to take all this data, bundle it up, and it ships it off to a .Mac server. And the way that it ships the data off, each record, so each event in your calendar or each entry in your address book or each bookmark is tagged individually. And you can then sync that data with, I believe, up to five other Macs, but it may even be more than that. I sync with three. And the idea is that if you make a change to a bookmark on one computer, or you add a bookmark or you delete a bookmark, it goes ahead and syncs that with the rest of your computers on the schedule that you set. If you tell it to do it automatically, it happens pretty much regularly. Otherwise, you can do it every hour or every day or whatever you like. So or manually even. And then as a safety net, if you're changing more than 5% of the data store of any one of those things, it'll actually warn you. And it deals with conflicts and all that. So that's what .Mac Sync does. It is a two-way sync or a multi-way sync, if you will. And it goes fairly deep into everything that it does. John, I know we both use it. John, I'll let you talk first about how you use it and your experience with it.
My experience has been pretty good, and actually I'm looking at the way I have it set up. So I use it among three different computers, portable and two desktop machines. And I set it on automatic, and I believe that is, you may remember that.
Okay.
But anyways, I use it, you know, I'm very happy with the bookmark synchronization. The calendar, now I use it also in conjunction with iSync. So what I do is, so I have, you know, at the 9 to 5, I have, we run Lotus Notes and I use something called Easy Sync, which syncs with my palm. But then I also sync that palm on my Mac. So I have two copies of, or actually three. So one is in Notes, one is in iCal, one is on the palm itself. And I go between them all. To me, that's useful. I always like having, especially for important stuff like, you know, my calendar or my contact list, I always like having multiple copies of it. And having it online is pretty good. But I also use iSync. So to me, because I rely on iSync to talk to both my Palm and my my Crazer phone, where I sync a subset of my contacts, you know, to the cell phone list, that's the way I use it. You know, the keychain thing is pretty much transparent. I don't use mail. I use Eudora. So that's how I use it. And then I do also use some of the, you know, this is where Apple kind of digs into this, is that I do use it to, you know, they give you now more disk space, 10 gigs now, I guess.
Right.
But I also use it with now iWeb. It was homepage, but, you know, it's also a place, you know, and I make use of that also. Of course, there are many other services that do that sort of thing. But to me, I like the whole package. I don't really use the iDisk syncing part of it or use the public sharing folder part, though that's something that, you know, may drive some other people to use it. So that's kind of a nutshell,
yeah.
How I use mine, but I'm very pleased with it. Now I know you have issues, especially with, I guess, when it decides to do what it wants to do.
Well, yeah. Okay. So I do something not dissimilar to you. I'm not syncing with a note server on the other end, but I do sync with my, I've got three machines. I've got my MacBook Pro, of course, in the office that I use all day. And then I've got the dual G4 that I'm on now up here in the studio. And then I have an iMac G5 back at the house. And I do sync my bookmarks, my address books, my keychains, and my mail signatures across all three of those. And then from my MacBook Pro, I also, using Missing Sync from Markspace, I sync my data with my Palm. But really, I don't think there's anything coming from sync services at this point. I mostly sync my calendar, which is now up to date, and contact. So, take the Trio out of it. It's those three computers. And when it works, it's great. It really, really works well. My problems and complaints with it are in the speed in which it takes. Oh, and I also sync Yojimbo. And this may be part of my issue here, because Yojimbo is syncing large chunks of data. I have PDFs in there. You know, I've got, anytime you folks send an email that we're going to read on the show, I send that to Yojimbo so that it's synced. And if I do it on my MacBook Pro, bam, it's up here in the studio, and I just expect it to work, and it does. But it's very slow about the way that it syncs. And also, I've had problems multiple times with it getting confused. Now, I realize I'm syncing three computers here, but I'm not changing data in three places a lot. You know, I may change data on my computer during the day, and then maybe two or three nights later, I might make a change at the iMac at the house. And then very, very rarely do I even make a change here in the studio. So, you know, the fact that once every 2 months I have to tell one of my computers to wipe all of its data and take a new copy down from .Mac because it stopped syncing correctly or whatever is a real pain. And then on top of that, the amount of processor time that it uses while it's syncing is not to my preference. So you've heard me rant about .Mac. I haven't had an issue lately. What? Go ahead, John.
I said, yes, I have heard you.
You have. We all have. Yeah. It could be better, but I have not tried sync together yet, but I've been considering trying that as an alternative. .Mac sync hasn't run me into that point yet, but I may get there. So there you go. That's that. So moving on here, John, do we have time to talk about this next one? The George's comment. I think we might. You want to go there? Let's go there. We've told them about it. George writes, I have a question that's been bugging me for a while regarding RAM utilization by applications in OS X. I've got a G5 dual 2.5 gigahertz with 3.5 gigs of RAM installed running 10.3.9 Panther right now. I'm still waiting on the Leopard release, and it seems that there's no way to force an application like iDVD or iPhoto to use more than a default amount of memory. In macOS Classic, you could set memory usage in the Get Info dialog of the application file. Am I just missing something, or is an inherent limitation of these programs in OS X? I've done some limited searches for Unix commands to get around this issue without success. It seems that some of the iLife applications would work better and faster by reducing or eliminating page outs to disk if they used more than 5 to 10% of the available RAM when 80 to 90% of the RAM remains unused. We've had similar conversations here before, John, and this does open a whole can of worms. You want to start this, or you want me to roll with it?
Let's not open the can too much. I mean, I would just then, and also I believe the writer said he sees page outs. Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah, and I guess to start off, that is a sign that your memory, how do they put it? I think it's oversubscribed when you start paging out too much.
Yep.
So that's a good thing that because my, when I first started reading this, I thought, well, why does he think that he's running out of memory?
Right.
You know, but you know, that is the first thing that you're going to see is too many page outs. As far as how to, I mean, you and I have our thoughts. I mean, I think, you know, there are certain strategies to reduce the possibility of that happening. I think the biggest one in my book is don't have a boatload of applications all open and kind of sitting around, even though you can do it.
Bingo.
You know, the more the OS has to deal with, the greater the possibility that either, you know, an app is going to grab RAM, even though it's not doing anything. And things will get more fragmented, and eventually the OS comes in saying, you know, there's a problem here. I better start doing these page outs. So in my mind, you know, short of getting more RAM, which, sure, try to only run things that you are actively using and you need. You may have some other thoughts that we don't. Again, this could take a whole show.
yeah, it totally could. The first thing is, George, no, there's no way to tell an application how much RAM to grab. It's grabbing it dynamically. Really, each application has access to 4 gig and 32-bit, a 4-gig partition of RAM, right? And then in 64, it goes up substantially. The OS is going to give the application what it needs. As John pointed out, though, if you're seeing page outs, well, that means that the OS has run out of RAM and needs to, for lack of a, to oversimplify it, needs to make some room. So it takes some stuff that's in RAM, it saves it out to disk and shuffles things around and makes some more room for whatever it is that needs to be there. But that page out process is very costly time-wise because it's taking something in RAM, which is very, very fast access, and saving it out to disk, which comparatively very, very slow access. So remember, if it's saved it out to disk, then chances are you're going to need it again. It's got to read it back in from the disk. John, your suggestions, both of them were right on. One, quit all the other apps. Makes a huge difference. Number two, get more RAM. That's the magic answer. If you ask me, I run 2 gigs of RAM on my MacBook Pro. I'm constantly paging out. I do wind up having quite a few apps open, classic apps not classic apps, but 68K apps or PowerPC apps. Anything running Rosetta, that's a much better term.
It costs
a lot of RAM. So,
okay, I want to mention one thing, though I don't think either of us have tried this, and you know I should, but remember there's something called iFreeMem.
Yeah,
from what I can see, I've never used it, but yeah, maybe you could comment, but I think it's something that helps you get more free memory.
It does. What it does is the OS will cache memory and it takes, there's things that it needs and that it calls active RAM, right? There's things that it cannot live without, and that's wired RAM, right? That stuff can never be paged out. Then there's the things that it's currently using, could be paged out, but aren't because of whatever reason, and those are active. Then you've got inactive RAM and free RAM. And again, this is an oversimplification, but the inactive RAM, well, it's still taking up RAM. It's just stuff that the OS knows it could get rid of if it had to. And more often than not, if you've got a bunch of apps open, you'll see that OS 10 is sitting there at, your free RAM is very, very low, down, you know, less than 100 megs. Whereas the inactive RAM might be really, you know, really, really big. So what iFreeMem does is it takes all that inactive RAM and frees it up so that you've actually, at the end of the process, you're left with more free RAM. And that can make a big difference. Now, it can also slow some things down. Some applications, you know, might call on whatever was in inactive RAM, and then that's got to be read back in off the disk. It does page things out and move things around a little bit. So the magic answer is what you said, John. Get more RAM if you can. I'm maxed out on my machine and it's not enough. Or quit apps when you're not using them, especially big memory hungry things like anything in Rosetta. That's going to use just more RAM out of the gate. Safari is another thing. Quit that, you know, a couple times a day. It has a massive memory leak. It'll really start to eat up RAM and drive you crazy. Certainly quit it if you leave your computer overnight. Quit it when you leave your desk so that by the time you get there in the morning, the machine's had free RAM all night and it's been able to do all its processes and that'll actually work. I found the same thing is true with iChat. It bloats up, at least the way I have mine and the way I use it and configured. So I wind up quitting that too at the end of the day. And that helps quite a bit. So yeah, quit as much as you can when you're not going to be using stuff. And I think that's the answer there.
I'm with you, brother.
All right, let's move on to Roger here. Roger writes, "My printer is hooked up to my 20-inch iMac running the latest version of Tiger. When I want to print something, either using a MacBook and a work laptop running Vista and Bonjour, I have to wake the iMac from its sleep in order to print. It kind of defeats the purpose of setting it up to share the printer if I have to run into the room where the printer is and wake up the iMac before printing. Is there a workaround for this?" You want to take this one, John?
I'll give you some thoughts. So first off, we didn't get the detail about what type of printer it is. I'm going to assume, but actually I just thought of something while were talking. So I think our assumption here is that this is a USB printer and that the computer is connected to a high-speed connection via Ethernet.
Yeah.
It doesn't have to be the case. It could be an Ethernet printer and the machine is hooked up using AirPort. That's another potential.
I would say we're 99% safe in assuming that it's a USB printer, because if it was an Ethernet printer, he probably would have realized that he can just plug it into the network and then anything can print to it.
Unless he doesn't have a hub, in which case there's your answer. But anyway, so I would say, yeah, the thing is, I mean, when the machine's asleep, it's except for, and I'll hand this off to you because I think you found something regarding this, Dave. At least yep. I think you did. But, you know, there's this one kind of obscure setting in the, is it sharing? I forget where, or energy saver.
Yeah.
And it says wake for Ethernet network administrator. And this will only work, not with wireless Ethernet, unfortunately, because I found this because I tried to do this and it didn't work. But with wired Ethernet, there is a certain signal that you can send down the wire to a computer saying, hey, I'm the administrator, dude, wake up.
Yeah, that's right.
Otherwise, short of, you know, hitting the keyboard or the mouse or something, the machine is not going to wake up for, you know, because it can't hear you. So now, did you say you found, or did you find this utility? There was a...
Yeah. So there's a couple of ways to do that. Assuming the computer is on Ethernet, and I do this all the time because the computer up here in the studio goes to sleep. And I'll need to get a file that's, you know, we share some of our accounting data from this computer just because of the way the office works, and Lisa's up here sometimes when she's working. And so I need to wake the computer up. Now, certainly I could get up from my desk and come up here and do it. And I'll do that if I'm on the phone or whatever. But if I just need to wake it up quick, I actually open Apple Remote Desktop. And when I in Apple Remote Desktop, you can highlight a computer that it knows about and go to the manage menu and choose wake. And then from there, you wake up the computer and it works flawlessly. But this is not an Apple specific protocol. This is an Ethernet specific protocol. Again, has to be wired, but it can send this pulse along. And as long as the Ethernet card on the other end or the Ethernet adapter on the other end understands it, it will wake the computer up. There is a third party utility. I believe it's a piece of freeware. We found it at Version Tracker, our new CNET friends. Called Wake on LAN, funnily enough. And I've used this utility before, and it's the first time you use it, you've got to go jump through some hoops. You've got to type in the MAC address of the Ethernet port that you're going to wake up. And it's not as intuitive as we Mac users have become accustomed to. But it is free. So you can do it with Apple Remote Desktop, or you can do it with Wake on LAN. One option costs money and is as easy as pie. The other, you got to jump through some hoops, but once you do it the first time, it saves it in a list and you're good to go.
Huh. Okay. And then I have another thought.
Yeah.
First off, in order to, you know, I've been hearing, you know, some kind of, you know, disturbing things about the economy. So in order to, you know, stir the economy and get people to buy stuff, I want to suggest buying something to let you do.
Good.
But there are, for example, our friends at Keyspan, and there are probably others, but those are the ones I'm most familiar with, make either USB or specific USB print servers, which you can then plug into an Ethernet network, and the printer is always available. Even though it's a USB printer, you know, it has a USB port and an Ethernet port, so you make it a network printer. And then there are also wireless options, like I still have a older HP wireless print server that's actually one end is parallel, the other it plugs into the parallel port and makes it wirelessly accessible by Apple Talk. But then I think you also pointed out, Dave, I guess this has been happening for a while, but the AirPorts now, in addition to disk servers, are also print servers. So there's another option if you have look on the back of your AirPort if that's what you're using, or make Apple happy and buy a new 802N AirPort.
You know, Roger's question reminded me of something. The last time we talked about doing something like this, we're using a printer and sharing it and what the best way was. I had the same situation as Roger, very, very similar, actually. Have an iMac in the house and was hanging a printer off of it via USB. And the same thing would happen. Somebody in the house would want to print either from the Windows machine or the Mac, and they'd want to go, you know, we'd have to wake up the iMac in order for them to print. And we're sitting here doing the podcast, John, and we're talking about wireless print options. And this same conversation happened, you know, okay, well, you can do this. And then, of course, you know, the airport base stations have it. And I'm sitting here doing the show, and this light went off. Right next to the iMac is the airport base station that we use in the house to manage the wireless network. I mean, it's sitting right next to it. And, of course,
visible.
It's got the USB port on the back of it. I'm thinking, I have been a dum-dum for 18 months sitting here with this thing just like this, waking up this iMac and fighting with it to get it to print. As soon as we finished the podcast, I ran over to the house, unplugged the USB from the iMac, plugged it into the airport base station, and life has been grand ever since. So just because Roger didn't mention that he had an airport base station doesn't mean that he doesn't have one, because he too might be in the same boat as dear old Dave. So
no, I think they may also make fairly low cost, I guess, USB to Ethernet.
Yes.
Just like dongles or kind of, you know, that. Yep. That's all they do. They're not a server like the Keyspan products, which, you know, I think give you a bit more functionality and control, but it's just a converter of sorts. And
well, no, it has to be a server. If you're connecting USB to Ethernet, something's got to manage the print jobs coming in, because you could have, you know, conflicting jobs coming in and beating against each other. So even those quote unquote cheap little USB to Ethernet devices are print servers, and you can get them for less than $100. But if you're thinking of upgrading your router, you're probably better off just getting something with the USB built in, because it, dollars for donuts, you'll get more for less. So,
okay, no, I was thinking of actually something even lower cost, which I've seen on some computers, but all it does is give you an Ethernet port off a USB port. It doesn't do any server functionality, but that's more for just people that just want a network.
Oh, yeah, I see what you're saying. Going the other way around.
Yeah,
but that wouldn't work for his printer.
Right, still need something to do the print serving portion of the equation.
Yeah, you can't take one of those USB to Ethernet adapters and plug it into a printer. That those are only meant for computers to get them on a network. I use one for my TiVo, right? I plug it into the USB port on the TiVo, and then it connects the TiVo to my network. But the TiVo has drivers in it for that, and the printer wouldn't have drivers, and you wouldn't be able to get to the printer to configure it anyway. So,
yep, just thinking out loud, because I've seen those things. Okay.
Sponsor number two is Audible at audible.com/MacGeekGab. And going there, you'll get one free download from Audible and a 14-day free trial of Audible Listener Gold. Any content that you get from Audible, you can listen to on your iPod, your iPhone, your Trio. You can burn it to a CD. You can listen to it on a Mac. You can listen to it on a PC. They've got 35,000 titles and probably even more now. All sorts of stuff. I like to download some, as you know, I like to download some comedy stuff that I listen to when I'm driving home late at night from gigs. They've also got some Mac-related books. We've talked about I Was, How I Invented the Personal Computer and Had Fun Along the Way. Stephen Levy's The Perfect Thing, How the iPod Shuffles Commerce, Culture, and Coolness. And the Icon Steve Jobs book, the second, I always do this, I did it last time, I'm doing it this one. Icon Steve Jobs book, the greatest second act in the history of business. But really, I was thinking about that. It's actually this third act, isn't it? But we'll let that go. Audible.com/MacGeekGab gets you a free download. You got to visit that link to do it. You can click here in the show notes. You can click at the link that Michael has put in the enhanced feed, or you can type it into your browser on your, well, I guess you wouldn't do it on your iPhone, because you're not going to be able to download on your iPhone. You've got to download on your Mac, and then you can sync it to your iPhone via iTunes. Audible.com/MacGeekGab. And with that, we're going to go to Travis and see if we can't help him out.
Hey, John and Dave. This is Travis from Ohio. I've got a quick question about a problem I'm having with an external hard drive of mine. I use it for backups and hooked it up the other day. And by accident, I had rested some books on the desk, and it laid across the power cord and disconnected it. Of course, I got the error message saying, you know, it wasn't properly unmounted, and so I plugged it back in and restarted it, and I'm not getting anything to show up. It's not mounting on the desktop. Open up Disk Utility, it's not showing up as a mounted drive there either. However, if I do open up Disk Warrior, I can see it there. It does give me a message saying the drive is not visible, but I ran you know, I repaired permissions on the disk and rebuilt the directory, and just found a few small issues with the directory, replaced that, and but it's still not giving me anything as far as being able to mount it and use it. So I don't know if I, you know, did some bad things to that drive when it disconnected, or if there's a way I can maybe salvage some data that's on there, or just maybe a quick fix to get it to remount and go on my way. But anyway, just wonder if you could help me with that. I know you guys have mentioned Drive Genius in the past. So curious to see what your thoughts are. Appreciate your help, and thanks a lot.
Yeah, that's not good.
I got one thing. I just a mini tangent here, but just one thing. So I believe it was mentioned it was an external drive, right?
Yeah.
All right. Now, there is something, you know, it's old to me and you, but just something to mention to prevent. So this is kind of, you know, 2020 hindsight. But there's something called file system journaling that is something, if you're going to, you know, create an external drive, you want to make sure. I don't believe I think it's usually on by default, but it's a feature that gives you better drive integrity and can guard, though not totally guard, against this sort of thing happening. But it sounds like, you know, the power was yanked at exactly the wrong time.
It certainly does. I'm frankly a little surprised that if Disk Warrior was able to see the drive, that it wasn't able to rebuild the directory. But the fact that it wasn't, you said, you know, Greg Snyder here at Backbeat Media saw a similar issue where he was losing files off of his drive. Things were going south, and Disk Warrior wasn't able to rebuild it, and nothing really was. He did try Drive Genius. For him, it didn't work. There's no reason not to try it, Travis. In fact, there's no reason not to try anything at this point. Remember, Disk Warrior does something different from every other disk utility, and that is it doesn't go in and try to fix the directory. It just goes in and rebuilds it from what it sees. So the problem with that is once it's done that, rarely do you have the ability to go in and fix anything because the old directory is gone. Disk Warrior does let you do a compare and contrast, and you can even sometimes pull files off during that compare and contrast. So that might not be a bad place to check. But certainly Drive Genius won't hurt. If you've got a bad sector, Drive Genius can search for and find and remap that, and maybe that'll do it. You know, the one thought that I came up with, of course, John, you know, as we were talking about this prepping for the show, was it's an external drive. And the FireWire interface does add a layer of obfuscation, if you will, where the machine isn't talking directly to the drive. It's talking via the FireWire chipset, and who knows what capabilities that chipset has. So if you have the ability to take the drive out of the FireWire case and mount it inside a Mac, any Mac, that may allow Disk Utility to do a whole lot more with it. And will also allow Drive Genius to do a whole lot more with it. So that, you know, at this point you're kind of grasping for straws. There is, of course, the Drive Savers and Total Recall route. That's not cheap, but is all but guaranteed to get your data off the drive. So that's, those are my thoughts.
Safe mode is one possible. Yeah, you know, again, it's grasping for straws.
Yep, yep. But you know, but it always is grasping for straws, right? If you got, you know, a disk that's gone south, all you're doing is you're just looking to grab the right straw at the right time. That's you know, to extend the analogy, which after living in Austin, Texas, for as long as I did, that extended analogy is an art form. So I have a have a soft spot in my heart for it. So I had a geek challenge set up for the show that we were going to share with all of you, and we're going through the show notes, and
John
ruined it, but here we go. It's a good one.
Hey, John and Dave. This is Paul calling from sunny Los Angeles, California. Just wanted to say I really, really enjoy your podcast. It's one of my top three on my must-listen list. Have a quick question regarding hacking the Finder. I really, really want to change one of the characteristics about the Finder, where when you duplicate a file, as we all know in OS X, it creates the file with the word copy, a space, and then the word copy at the end of the duplicated file. What I'd like to do is change that so that I don't see space copy. I see another character, one that I use quite a bit in my workflow. What I'm doing right now is creating duplicates and then using a drag and drop to automatically change space copy into another character. I'd like to be able to do that or have the OS do that for me. Do you guys know of any way of doing that?
All right. So that was going to be the Geek Challenge, and then we were going to move on and tell you a little bit about this Culture Catch party and go home. But John, you ruined it.
I was going to say, dude, that is so easy. What you do is you go to System, Library, Core Services, Finder. You then right-click on that and say Show Package Contents, and then you drill down a little bit more and go to Contents, Resources, English.lproj. Local, and then there's a file called localizable.strings. And of course, what you want to do when you're in that file is look for a string that has a key of N4. What happens is, and then there's going to be a value associated with that key, and it's going to be caret 0 space copy. The caret 0 is actually a placeholder for whatever variable was passed in by the Finder. So, to me, that's just pretty blazing obvious.
Yeah, well, you know, I've seen that many, many times, but it's just so common, John, that I just didn't think to mention it. That's all.
No,
you know, I thought he wanted a more robust solution.
No. So, anyways, that tip of the hat here to our folks at macOS 10 Hints, and this was due to my Google Foo is strong.
Yes. Well,
basically I came across this. Now the thing is in that file. So a little, you know, danger, Will Robinson, be careful when you mess with this file, because this is stuff that's core to the OS as far as what the Finder says and does in certain situations. If you mess it up, so maybe you want to make a backup of that file before you start messing around with it.
That's not,
but
a bad
actually
move.
Looking through this file, I mean, there looks to be a couple of hundred interesting little strings there. And, you know, anytime peeking through this may reveal some secrets, and that's all I'll say.
Oh, we like that. We like secrets, John. We don't like when you tease us, though. But I am going to tease everyone now. I took a couple of minutes earlier this week to talk to Dusty Wright of Culture Catch, and they are putting on this big party at Portable Media Expo. Gosh, it's not end of next week, isn't it? It is, yeah. End of 2 weeks away from tonight, right? And he told us all about it. I'm gonna play this interview for you. So sit back, relax, enjoy. It's a couple minutes here, and then John and I will be back to wrap things up for you, because we've got actually an announcement about the next show. It's very important. It sounds good.
Okay, good.
It sounds good. So thanks for taking the time to come and tell me more about this party and tell all our listeners more about this party. It's September 28th at Portable Media Expo at the Convention Center, right, Dusty?
Exactly, Dave. It's 8 to 11. We've got a lot of fantastic eye candy for the guys, because we know there are a lot of guys there. We've got Drea Weber's aerial ballet. Drea, we could probably classify her like a Cirque du Soleil performer.
Oh, okay.
And because we have really high ceilings, she's going to do something pretty spectacular. She's done a lot of rock and roll tours and choreographed a lot of stuff, so that should be rather stunning. We've got the trio, the rock funk trio, I should say, from San Francisco. Von Iva.
Oh.
Got a new CD out, and rumors have that Scott Whelan's kind of looking at the ladies for maybe picking them up for his new label.
Wow.
They're tremendously dynamic. We just did their record release party in New York at Gibson, and we were blown away by their dynamics.
Awesome.
And we know people are going to love them. We've got some belly dancers, the superstar belly dancer troupe from Los Angeles. They might incorporate some Brazilian dancing as well. We thought that would be a nice adjunct to this amazing world-class DJ that we've lined up, DJ David Starfire. Our friends over at IOTA Promo Net tipped us to him. He is fantastic. You know, he has some really great world beat grooves that he mixes in with all the new current stuff to give it more of an organic trip-hop vibe.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
So that should work really, really well with the belly dancers. We're even going to do some body painting. It'll be a little bit different than last year's body painting motif.
All right.
But it should be interesting nonetheless. That's all I'll say about it.
Yeah.
You can show up to find out what our spin is on it.
There you go. That sounds like it's not a party unless you're painting pieces of yourself, I think.
That's
a mandatory thing.
Indeed, indeed. And we'll also have a fantastic raffle with over $7,500 worth of stuff.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and our sponsors have really gone out of the way. Gibson Guitar, Shure, Monster Cable, Griffin Technology, who am I missing? JBL.
Wow.
Really should be some dynamic gifts. The raffle will be really well worth the effort.
So if somebody's going to PME, there's no reason not to go to this party. I mean, what the heck else are you going to do on Friday night?
And basically, we've been there, Dave. We know the score. We were trying to do something really creative. Then we realized it was a space limitation.
Right.
And we thought, well, that's not good. Because you want everyone to share it. I think that's the beauty of our business. The podcasters are a big, giant community. We continue to evolve and grow up together.
There you go.
And I think the beauty of our industry, again, is how much we share from day to day, just business to business.
Yep.
You know, the viral marketing aspects really allow us to flourish with each other and feed off of each other, if you will.
So this is Friday night, 7:30 it starts, right?
7:30, yeah.
Okay.
I said 8, didn't I? It's 7:30.
That's 7:30.
You know, it really is. I think if we really add it up, it's a celebration for podcasters.
Well, that's what we need. So everybody come Friday night, 7:30. It's at the convention center, and it's going to be a blast. Thanks for...
Oh, you know what? I forgot to say, you guys are the official media sponsor.
We are. Yeah, I'll tell them. I'll make sure.
Okay. Yeah. How do I forget you?
It's all right, man.
All right, man. All right, David.
Thanks for coming and telling everybody about it, man. I'm looking forward to seeing you later this month.
Yeah, definitely. It'll be fun.
Thanks, man.
Well, I'll catch up.
All right. So that should be a blast. Good to have something to do at PME, I think. So
that was Dusty.
That was Dusty. Yeah.
Yeah, he gets around, man. I've seen him at the New York events and stuff.
Yeah, he's a New York guy. That's right.
Oh, that's right. There you go.
All right. So let's talk about a couple of these things here. We've got, of course, Michael Johnston has converted this show into AAC for your listening and viewing pleasure, and he is the executive publisher, I believe, of iPhoneAlley.com, a proud member of the Backbeat Media Network. Of course, the podcast and New Media Expo is September 28th through 30th. That's 2 weeks from tonight it starts. John and I will be there, or 2 weeks from earlier today it starts, believe it or not. It goes all day Friday. So John and I will be there. Of course, the party Friday night, and... all sorts of stuff happening all weekend. John and I might even be podcasting from the Ambrosia booth there, but we're going to figure that out. Got to figure out
Ambrosia?
The logistics. Yeah, they've got a booth there, so we're going to see how that goes.
Oh, I love their stuff.
But between now and then, we have one more podcast to do, and we're going to try and do it on the normal schedule, which would be Monday the 24th, I believe, would be the next show that we've got coming up. And I know
it rings a bell.
What kind of bell? What are you talking about, John?
I don't know. I thought something important happened that day.
Something very important happened that day. Do you know what it is, John?
I think one of us was born.
Yeah. Yeah. Sadly.
And it wasn't me.
No,
so
that's right. So it is the, it's going to be the It's My Birthday and I'll Review What I Want to show. I know we just did a review cast.
I didn't mean to do that on my birthday. That's not fair.
Well, you can do it this next time around. If the podcast falls on your birthday, then that's the rule. But I wound up getting both a Nano and a new Classic this week, and I want to tell you about them, especially the Nano. It's cool. So I want to spend a little more time with it before talking about it. But
It's like, I love how just the form factor is just so funny. I mean, it's like,
Dude. Yeah,
compared to the others.
Yeah. Yeah. So we'll talk about that next time. And of course, we'll still be answering your questions. The reviews will be, it won't be an entire review cast. It'll just be a little bit about that. And then we'll move on. So, looking forward to hearing from you all with your questions, comments, concerns, queries, and whatever else it is.
Yep, and you got something to say, you know, iTunes is always good. Nice review. And vote on
Podcast Alley.
Yeah. And maybe leave a comment there. We love the comments that we've seen there. I forget the one I saw. I think it says, Mackie Gab rocks my face off, which I'm still...
I like that.
I thought that was fun. That's good. I don't know if that's good or I think that's good.
I hope that's good. All right, that's it. Cashfly Hosting is the place where you downloaded this show from. The podcast marketplace this month has the A5 and A2 desktop speakers from Audio Engine, BB Edit from Barebone Software, one free download from Audible, and PDF Pen from Smile on My Mac. If you want to sponsor the show, Backbeat Media Podcast Network, but we're getting pretty full.
And we tricked them this time because we did it on a different day. You know what's not going to happen?
They won't get caught. They know not to get caught because they know what? It's important.
Made up.